This is Karen Brewster, and today is March 10th, 2015, and I'm here with Morris Morgan at his home out Chino Hot Springs Road in Fairbanks, Alaska. Thank you, Morris, for agreeing to be interviewed.
Thank you for coming.
All right. So, to get us started, why don't you tell me a little bit about your childhood, when you were born and where you were born?
Well, I was born in Grangeville, Louisiana, October 19th, 1920. My mother's name was Sadie. My dad's name was DeWitt. And I was raised up in St. Helena Parish. And it was pretty well known as the Piney Woods.
What does that mean?
Well, it was similar to a strip of pine forest that went from the Atlantic coast across to East Texas. Some of my earliest memories are about the schoolhouse. It was called Forest Hill, and it was empty and hadn't been used for several years. And I looked inside through the window, and there seemed to be a stage all the way across the school. And later on, I was able to get inside of it, and it seemed that they had built the porch on the wrong side. They should have had it on the outside. But at any rate, it served them well, I guess. The whole thing was one room, but it was a huge area. And my cousin and I, we communicated by hollering, shouting, and the acoustics in there convinced me that I had somewhat of a prospect in the educational field because I did holler fairly loud. I didn't realize the tyranny that accompanied the educational dynasties, but I later on found out about them. And my grandparents on my mother and father's side were very interested in education. My grandfather Morgan was superintendent of education of St. Helena Parish for 27 years. He had donated the lumber and built this school that I described earlier. And he also boarded teachers that taught in the school.
Growing up, school education was emphasized in your family?
Yes, and my mother's father and mother sent five girls to college. How in the world they managed this, it's hard to explain. But they rented their farm out and moved miles away so the girls could attend college. I'm not just sure how academic these colleges were that girls went to, but as I understand it, they were sort of finishing schools and they were felt to be necessary for lady folks to have the training on how to become lady folks, I guess.
Mm-hmm. And now, was your mother one of those five girls?
Yes.
And do you remember what kind of school she had? Like, was it a finishing school?
Yes.
Or secretary? Did they learn secretarial?
I don't know what all was taught there. They existed scattered all about over the South were these colleges. Mm-hmm. don't know much about them really, except that I was impressed that he could rent his farm out, and he rented his farm for $5 a month. Which indicates that there wasn't much money available in those days. On my father's side, he went to LSU, Louisiana State University, and it was called the Old War School. ROTC was a very important part of the college. He was subsequently went to Memphis to a medical school. His father wanted him to be a surgeon, and he didn't want to be a surgeon, so he came back home after a while of dissecting cadavers. It wasn't his line of work, apparently. But he always did respect the value of the university.
So what did your father end up doing instead of being a surgeon?
He was in the lumber business.
What does that mean?
Well, he cut timber and sawed it into lumber and sold the lumber. He inherited from his father what I like to call, for a better word, was an industrial complex of a sawmill and a gin, a cotton gin, and blacksmith shop, and just a whole little conurbation of industries appropriate for that time and space. Mm-hmm. This was destroyed in 1925 by arson, and from that time on we were unemployed, and homeless.
What was that
like? We were homeless because he had bargained, he'd borrowed $695 from the Bank of Greensburg. And since his mill and everything about it was destroyed, he couldn't take advantage of the timber that he had bought with this money. As a consequence, we lost our home for the lack of $695, which in those days was an awful lot of money. Mm-hmm. So we were sort of unemployed, no home, no jobs, and then the Depression hit with 1925, times weren't very good, as particularly if you're homeless and unemployed. So we moved to Baton Rouge, about 30 miles away. And Dad tried first one job, then another. But we were, by all kinds of figuring, we were poverty-stricken.
Yeah.
And completing 11 years of schooling, I went to 9 different schools.
Wow.
So I had to establish a pecking order that I was satisfied with at least 9 times.
And where were you in the pecking order?
I didn't come out too well in some schools. Some schools I was not too picked on. But bullying did occur and was often settled with fist fights. But I tried to avoid these as best I could. But the beginning of my schooling formally was when I went to elementary school. My mother tutored me, prompted me, that is, before I left for school, and asked that I state my birthday and my name and be sure to be able to give that to the teacher, because she knew that it would be asked for. So I mumbled this all the way to school. We rode in an old, actually it was a wagon, to school that Mr. LeBlanc owned. All the way to school I was repeating this over and over. I'm Herbert Morris Morgan. I was born October 19, 1920. And when the teacher asked me, I rattled that off. I'm Herbert Morris Morgan. I was born October 19, 1920. And she marveled at that. Some little kids didn't know when they were born. Some of them weren't sure they had been born. Some of them didn't know all their names. And some were just simply terrified and crying and didn't give up much information. So as a consequence, I was singled out as to how a student should be, and therefore properly hated by the rest of the kids in the class. But that kind of notoriety I soon learned to try to avoid.
You were the teacher's pet. They didn't like that.
I got to be the teacher's pet, and I didn't... I wished I wasn't.
Yeah.
So I had to try to tone down my academic achievements somewhat.
Yeah. Well, also, always being a newcomer, kids don't like the newcomers.
No.
You're the outsider.
They're the new recruits.
Yeah. So when you became unemployed and homeless, you said you moved to Baton Rouge. Where did you live? How did you have money to? Did you live in a shelter? Or?
My dad managed to find enough work to pay the rent for some of the time. And we moved from one house to another. I lived in one house that I had to sleep up in an attic because there wasn't enough room, and the rats bit me.
Oh, no.
On my toes and on my ears. But we got rid of the rats. But there was one year that we didn't have adequate clothes to go to school. And there were five of us. So we just stayed out of school for a year, all of us. It was hard times.
Yeah. I was going to ask if you had brothers and sisters. So there were five children altogether?
Yeah. I had two brothers and two sisters.
And where do you fall? In the middle? Or?
I'm the baby of the family.
Baby.
And that had its advantages and disadvantages.
What are the advantages and disadvantages?
Well, if you're the last piglet, you get the small teat. That was part of it. But I got adequate rations. But I was never a major figure in any decisions about what was to be done. I can remember being short-legged and small. I had to run to keep up. But I'm sure that most youngsters like that had that problem.
Yeah, well, What was the age difference between you and the oldest one? They were how many years older?
I'm not sure. And right now, and my memory is so bad, I can't. My oldest brother died of lung cancer from smoking cigarettes when he was 64 years old. He was a Harley-Davidson motorcycle dealer.
Uh-huh. And was he 10 years older than you?
At least, yeah. My mother developed cancer in 1925.
Wow.
At about the same time the mill burned. And she had surgery, had her hysterectomy, and survived to be 101 years old.
Wow.
So she was very active and very astute. She could beat you at a game of cards when she was 100 years old. She was a very strong person. I graduated from high school in Zachary, Louisiana.
And what?
I had a small class. It was 12 graduates in my class. And I had the luck to be chosen as a salutatorian. And that meant I had to make a speech at our graduation ceremonies, which I wasn't sure I was happy about that prize, but I did make a speech.
Do you remember what it was about?
The final sentence, I think, was the idea of a life. The idea is to make a life, not a living. So, I'm sure it was rousing enough.
So have you followed your own advice?
I've tried to. I think I have in some ways.
Well, it sounds like your growing up was difficult.
It was. We lived in a segregated society. And we were homeless and unemployed. And many people were, but we lived next door to black folks, and I remember fondly older black women that didn't mind giving me affections and let me hug them. I discovered that one family's house was on fire and I warned them about it and they put it out. And the lady that was the mama there, she gave me and her son a syrup bucket full of clabber, which was yogurt, really, and I didn't know it was yogurt. Probably wouldn't have eaten it. But she gave us each a spoon and one bucket, so I integrated that yogurt feast way before anything else was integrated.
And did she give you that yogurt as a thank you for
Yes,
helping
save we were
that
rewarded.
House?
Yeah.
Oh, nice.
I remember that very fondly.
Yeah, I was wondering, with your childhood, what kind of things you liked to do as a kid?
Hunting.
You liked to go hunting.
Yeah, I was hunting, putting food on the table, squirrels and rabbits, quail. I had an old double-barrel shotgun, a huge, long barrel, 32-inch barrel. It was in pretty bad shape, but I never missed a squirrel with it. Never, not a one. Shells were expensive, and you had to bring home the bacon, so to speak. My dad wouldn't eat any game meat, and but I used to guide rich people on hunts for quail. At one point in my teen years, we had custody of an 800-acre farm, and doves came in by the thousands, and some of Daddy's friends from college would come out and hunt doves. And they would reward me with school money, whatever school money meant. They would give me a dollar or 50 cents or something like that. But they gave me shells. When they had shells left over, they would complain that they had blood on them. They didn't want them. I had a big supply of shells, and I became quite adept at shooting. I still own my gun that was bought for me by my brother when I was 16 years old. It was a Sears Roebuck gun. Still have it.
That's nice. So, did your father, did he go hunting and teach you hunting?
He didn't hunt.
So how did you learn?
I just learned. I had that old gun, and we got hungry, and I went and got something.
How did you have that gun? Did it come from a grandfather?
It come from my dad, but he had gotten it from his father.
Okay.
It's just an old double-barreled, mule-eared shotgun, the kind that had the hammers on it. But I brought in a lot of meat with that old gun, and then when I got that pump gun at 16... It's Western Field, I believe, was the name of it. But I enjoyed hunting and fishing. I became quite good at bass fishing. And I made baits and sold bass fishing baits.
So what's bass fishing bait?
Well, there's different kinds of topwater baits. Hedden made a lot of them, and I had a collection of Heddens at one time. Today would be worth a lot of money, but they were stolen from me. The whole box was stolen. But I had a lot of fun fishing. That was when I was older, and I began to paint when I was in I forget what year. It was a year or two after I got out of the service. I began to dabble in painting and enjoyed it. I saved everything I did because I was not sure it was any good. But I'm sort of glad I did because I could look at it and see how bad it was and what needed to be done to improve it. But I had to work in the industries there in Baton Rouge to make a living. I worked with tetraethyl lead for 10 years. And when I realized that there was no future in that, I gave up that job and enrolled in college. That was after I'd gone to war.
Mm-hmm. Before we get to the war, you mentioned you were in 1925, the fire, and you were in such poverty, and then the Depression hit. You were already poor. What did the Depression do for your family?
It didn't help a great deal.
How did you guys get through that?
Well, we ate less. We wore our clothes out, literally. And Mother was always able to provide a meal. Things got pretty common sometimes, eating dried beans and collard greens and such. But I'd pay good money now for a mess of collards.
And was your father able to find any work at all during the Depression?
Yes, he had different jobs. There were jobs, but they were not fun jobs. He worked in the Mingle box factory where they made cartons, boxes for strawberries and beans and things like that. And I remember it being 11 cents an hour.
Wow.
But yeah, I may be wrong there. I worked plowing fields for people in my teenage years for 50 cents a day. And I was expected to go to work as soon as it was daylight and work until it was too dark to see.
Yeah.
And I got 50 cents for that.
Wow.
The lady realized that I wasn't eating anything all day, and so she upped my wages by giving me my dinner, which is what we call a noon meal down south.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah, so I was doing pretty good. I got a meal and got to work for 12, 14 hours.
Wow.
Made 50 cents. I took that home to Mama. And I think it was 64 or 65 cents you could get a 12-pound sack of flour. And you made shirts and such out of flour sacks. Fertilizer sacks you could make shirts out of them. And there was one bulldog fertilizer that you could, if you arranged it right, it could be right in the middle of the back of the shirt. We were sort of proud of that bulldog fertilizer on the back of your shirt. But I was in LSU for 2.5 years, and then the war came along. And 2 months after the Pearl Harbor, I joined the parachute groups.
The paratroopers?
It was parachute units, they called them. It later became, in August of that same year, it became the 101st Airborne.
Okay.
So I was in the 101st Airborne cadre before I knew I was in the 101st Airborne.
And you volunteered, or were you drafted?
I volunteered, yeah. And I never did get a lot of rank. I got up to buck sergeant.
Wow. What is that?
I wound up in New Guinea. First I went to Australia. We left out of Staten Island, went around through the Panama Canal, and westward we went. We stopped at Bora Bora. It's been made into a highfalutin place now. But we were fortunate enough to see it before it was spoiled.
Mm-hmm. And what year did you join the Army? Do you remember what year?
1942. Okay. February the 6th of 1942.
And you say you don't remember things.
Huh?
And you say you don't remember things. You, that date you know, right?
Well, some things I remember. I remember it took us 31 days to get to Australia.
That's not bad, by ship.
And we were on the old USS Uruguay.
Hmm.
One of the Cunard liners, I think it was.
So why did you decide to join the military?
Patriotic. As far as I know, that must have been a reason. I didn't think about it much at the time. I had 2.5 years of college. I didn't have to go in.
Yeah, you could have stayed in college.
I could have. But for some reason it sounded adventurous.
Mm-hmm.
And it turned out to be an adventure. We rode in a little narrow gauge train up to Townsville, Australia, from Brisbane, where we landed. And from Townsville, I went to New Guinea. I went to New Guinea with the Australians. Australian plane and Australians. We flew across the Coral Sea to Gili Gili. It's the southern tip of New Guinea.
Hmm. And were the Japanese in New Guinea, and so that was your
mission? Yes. Yes. Hmm. We were. Our main mission was to secure airstrips. On Guadalcanal, the Americans and the Japanese realized how important airstrips were at Henderson Field.
Mm-hmm.
And this was just across the strait, China Strait, to the tip of New Guinea. And we rebuffed a Jap invasion trying to capture Gili Gili. But on my way up, we were forced down by weather. We used up our fuel trying to get out of the bad weather, and we had to land on an island north of New Guinea. It was called Good Enough Island.
Good Enough Island.
Good Enough Island. And from there, we went back. Well, for the first time, we went to Gili Gili. And from there, I had various airstrips that I visited. I got a battle star for New Guinea and a battle star for the invasion of the Philippines.
And what did you do to earn those?
Oh, more or less being there.
But I would think the invasion of the Philippines must have been
it was
quite intense.
It was. We were We invaded that, I think, on the 20th of October, and I thought we were going to get there on my birthday, which would have been quite a celebration.
Yeah.
We landed on White Beach. But before we landed, we were on a Liberty ship from Brisbane to Tacloban. And disembarked on a cargo net hanging down the side of the ship. And the barges that were picking us up off the net, they had to run and get away from the ship because being strafed. And that left us hanging on the cargo net. We resented that a little bit.
Yeah.
But at any rate, subsequent to this, 350 men died on that ship. So, but we got on shore, and I vividly remember getting in a shell hole with two other guys and a little Filipino boy about 8 or 9 years old. He had on an undershirt. I remember it was an olive drab undershirt. We were being issued, still we were had our white ones. But this was the clothes he had on. And for some strange reason, I had a guitar with me. I had drugged through all these difficulties. And I was sitting in a foxhole strumming on this, and this little kid could sing "You Are My Sunshine" in English, every word of it. But beyond that, his English was non-existent. The governor of Louisiana used that song to get elected governor. Now, I don't remember his name. That's just as well. We got into some nastiness near Palo in the invasion, and we spent some pretty bad times. We had a lot of dead bodies. We had no food. I had a half a pear in 5 days. But we had no food. We captured a Japanese ammo dump and found out later that the trail back to it was mined, and we had just luckily not stepped on any of these.
How did you manage to get up a whole trail without stepping on one?
Look, I guess. I had learned to walk to the side of a trail. We did that. You don't walk right down the middle of them. But I was surprised to see them digging them out. Hmm. We got some relief after 5 days. They backed a dump truck in and dumped out a bunch of canned goods. But our outfit got poisoned on rotten spam.
Oh.
And I spent a lot of stretcher duty.
What does that mean, stretcher duty?
I was hauling guys who had got food poisoning. on stretchers. We was hauling them out. We didn't lose anybody for the food poisoning, but we lost a lot of guys from just diseases and dysentery and such as that. Mm-hmm. But the idea was we got relieved out of that particular place, and the commander of our outfit was relieved of his duty because of the foul up.
Which foul up? The spam or something else?
He led us into exactly the wrong place. Japanese bodies were laying everywhere. I left for the United States from the Philippines, from Tacloban. I noticed when the typhoon hit, they called it Tacloban. I never heard it pronounced that way.
I have no idea.
But the war ended when we were, I was still in Philippines.
And so what was that like when you heard the news, the war ended?
Well, we were privy to a good bit of news, and we knew about the atomic bombs. We also knew that if it hadn't been for the atomic bombs, we would have lost millions of GIs. And I come back home to an old communications boat, ship, old thing built in 1919, I reckon. It was riveted together, tied together with cables. It was a communications ship. The captain came by the Philippines and picked us up. The ones who had the highest points. We come home by points. How many whatever's attaboys we had or whatever.
Yeah, I was going to say, how did you earn points?
Oh, length of service, amount of combat, stuff like that. When we got over there, how long we'd been there. Sometimes our physical condition. But we landed in Angel Island. We got on we went to the mess hall, and German soldiers were directing traffic to the mess tables. They were prisoners of war. And one told me, "Sit there." And I went to another table and sat down. I wouldn't sit where he wanted me to sit.
So, 1944 is when you left the army?
I believe it was 45 in December. I forget that. And I met my wife. I still had my uniform on. I think the uniform's what did it. And we were married 56 years.
Wow.
She died in 2001, January,
mm-hmm.
breast cancer.
Mm-hmm. And where did you meet her? Were you back in Louisiana at this point?
Yes, went back to Louisiana and see my folks and all. And I wound up back in Texas. I was working at Texas Engineering Manufacturing Company in Arlington.
What did they make?
Airplanes.
Oh. So you were helping to build airplanes?
Yeah.
You want me to take a pause here? Shall we pause? Okay, we're back. So, before we leave your military service part of your life, I just wanted to ask you about having served in the military during World War II, and I'm sure it was a very difficult time period, but how do you feel about having served, what that meant to you?
I'm glad I did. It enriched my life. It scarred me some, physically and emotionally, but I'm glad I did it the way I did it. I'm glad I did what I did. There were times of frantic terrorizing things, and there were times of boredom, just plain boredom. You always wanted to be somewhere where you weren't. Mm-hmm. When are we going to move, you know, that kind of thing. But a lot of our problems were erased by the fact that we had a certain amount of humor, that we laughed at things that you normally wouldn't laugh at, but we devised ways to confound the commanders and such, and in some cases we got by with it.
Well, yeah, you said that the military allowed you to do things that you would never have done in civilian life.
Yes, like borrow jeeps from the Navy and color them different from the blue. Woody and I were on the beach at Tuckloban, and the Navy brought in a ship that opened up in front and all kind of goodies came out. Mm-hmm. There was a Navy corpsman on the shore, and we were standing there. We looked like pretty raggedy looking, looked like we'd been around a little. And he had a pith helmet on, and we'd never seen one of those on anybody, except in the movies maybe. But he was asking us where the ship should land, and we said, right there, way's coming, that's fine. And we didn't know that there was a big rock there, but he missed it. But the doors opened and all kind of goodies began to roll out. Mm-hmm. Trucks and half tracks, jeeps and everything. And Woody and I stood there, and the wave that came in ahead of this boat hit this Navy man. We stood far enough back because we knew that happened. And he got turned head over heels, and his hat flew up in the air. Remember that. But he went and got somewhere else after he got half-drowned. And this kid drove up a jeep, and that was obviously the last one, and he says, where you want this? He wanted to get out of it, get back on the boat. And we said, we'll take it from here. And so we got in the jeep and drove it into the jungle, borrowed a compressor and some olive drab paint, got some stencils, and we had a jeep for a while. But the officers found us with a Jeep that wasn't authorized. In fact, they couldn't find a way where it came from. They didn't know, but we never told them. We were in possession of General Suzuki's LaSalle automobile for a couple of days. He abandoned it at the Leyte airstrip at Tacloban. Mm-hmm. It was about a 38 LaSalle automobile.
One of those real big ones?
It was just below a Cadillac.
Okay.
General Motors. Japan had Chevrolets and everything. And
yeah.
Bought their oil from us, by the way. But we kept it for a little while, and the officers saw us with it and took it away from us. There's a tyranny always, you know.
They wanted it for themselves.
Yeah, they wanted it.
So did you get punished when you got caught for these things?
Oh, no.
They didn't throw you in the brig?
No. I went to the hospital once, rode the ambulance to the hospital, and I had a broken bone. And the major strapped me up and splinted me up and says, go to Ward 10. And I knew that if you got in that particular hospital, you were going to stay there for the duration, because I had a friend in there who couldn't get out.
Mm.
And so I didn't want to get stuck in that hospital, because if they got below a certain number of beds, they had to move closer to the front. So they kept everybody that was silly enough to come there. So I just went down the hall a ways, and I saw the ambulance. I came in, I went out and got in it. The driver didn't want to take me, but I outranked him, so he had to take me back to the outfit. I got back to the outfit, and it didn't give me any kind of duty or anything, and there was Captain Taylor, I believe, was in charge. And after about 3 or 4 days, he says, Morgan, would you please go get hid somewhere? The damn MPs are coming every day looking for you. I had been officially AWOL from the hospital, so that's another back mark on my record.
You were a troublemaker, weren't you?
Yeah, I was a troublemaker. I had to entertain myself somehow. But we had some good times, actually. We saw things we wouldn't normally see. I operated a small crash boat for a while, and I remember once a shark went under my boat sideways, and he was more than 14 feet long, because that was the length of my boat, and he was longer than my boat.
Wow.
That was a huge thing.
So you spent the whole time in the New Guinea in the Philippines?
Yes.
Yeah, okay.
I got a battle star for both of those.
Mm-hmm. And then you said you tried to enlist for Korea.
Yeah, and that was when I was working at Ethel Corporation. I'd been working there about 6 or 8 years. And the Korean War sprang up. And another friend of mine there and I got to talking about, I don't know what it is about the attraction of war. I'd seen enough of it to make me disgusted with it, which I am today. But we got to talking about going, and I went to Montgomery, Alabama, and got examined and failed physically.
Mm-hmm.
And I couldn't balance on my left leg because it's an inch shorter than my right leg.
Oh.
Yeah. So I remember a big fat major telling me I wasn't physically fit to serve in my country. And there's that tyranny again.
Yeah.
But
you were also probably older maybe than other soldiers by that time.
I'm not sure
how old
I was. But at any rate, I got turned down for that. And I'm lucky I did there. Mm-hmm. I stayed in the reserve for about a year. So I have a diploma from the Korean War somewhere.
Well, as you say, the horrors of war, but you still were interested in going back and serving.
Yeah, and I never can figure that out. I guess I was a little bit leaded. We worked with lead, and it would drive you nuts, you know. That was a dirty job.
That was in the military you worked with lead, or?
No, in the civilian life.
Okay.
I got a job with them after I got married. And
so tell me about your courtship with your wife. You said you met her when you came back. You were still in uniform.
I thought we weren't going to talk horrible things anymore. She was a very sweet lady.
And how did you meet her?
Well, she came down. She was a nurse in Parkland Hospital in Dallas, Texas. And she came down to visit some relatives, and that's when I met her.
In Louisiana, or you were in Texas? In
Louisiana.
Okay.
She was raised up in Clayton, New Mexico. And it wasn't long before I wound up in Dallas. Actually, Cockrell Hill. It's a little enclave in the middle of Dallas. And that's where I went to work for Texas Engineering Manufacturing.
Okay, that's... And didn't you meet your wife at a dance or something? She was back in Louisiana?
Yeah.
What, you just met her on the street?
No, they had a dance, and I knew her kinfolks. And that way I got introduced to her.
She struck you from across the room.
Say what?
You saw her from across the room and you knew you wanted to meet her.
Yeah, we danced real well together. That is the jitterbug age, you know. Mm-hmm. I've been known to dance my shoe soles out.
Wow. That's pretty good.
Well, it's... some of the things we did on... comical things we did that kept us from worrying too much. The Liberty ship that we went on to go to the Philippines had decided on pumping seawater up and running it through a wooden trough. And that trough was our latrine. And it was right out on the deck, so it was open air and eternally flushed with water. So we hit on the idea it would be a good idea to ball up a little piece of newspaper and light it and sit it in the current and see what the reaction was. Well, it was, you could smell hair burning. It didn't come out too well in the end, but it was laughable at first.
That's good. It sounds like you had some fun, that's for sure.
Yeah. Okay. We had to laugh.
I'm going to need to change the tape. Okay?